And good afternoon. On behalf of Connie Bolin, our Warbirds in Review founder, coordinator, and executive producer, and the EAA Warbirds of America, we welcome you to Warbirds in Review. This is our 21st year of displaying significant historical aircraft alongside the people who own, maintain, and fly them. Starting from humble beginnings and the presentations have developed into world-class productions for you, here in the audience, and for people around the world to enjoy. And we thank you to those who provide the aircraft and the dedicated volunteers who assist to make this possible. Thank you to Ron and Diane Fagan and the Fagan Fighters World War II Museum in Granite Falls, Minnesota, for the beautiful building that you see in front of you that makes this level of productions possible. And a special thank you to Jim Hagedorn and the Scotts Miracle-Gro Company for their long-lasting and continued support. Our mission is to recognize and honor the veterans who serve their country. As we entertain and educate, we continue to record history, heritage, and heroes in their own words. Thank you for being here to be a part of the program produced by Scott Guyette and the talented Sleeping Dog Productions team. Live streaming is provided through airtotv.com. Now, if you would, please direct your attention to the Jumbotron for the video introduction to this program.
Few aircraft are as well known or were so widely used for as long as the iconic C-47 Skytrain. Nicknamed Goonie Bird, the aircraft was adapted from the DC-3 commercial airliner, which first appeared in 1936. The first C-47s were ordered by the military in 1940. They carried personnel and cargo, and in a combat role, towed troop-carrying gliders and dropped paratroops into enemy territory. The C-47 Skytrain military transport aircraft played a major role in World War II in at least three theaters and proved beneficial to military operations around the world in roles that varied from limited to indispensable. General Dwight D. Eisenhower said, "Four things won the Second World War: the bazooka, the jeep, the atom bomb, and the C-47 Goonie Bird." By war's end, some 13,000 C-47 variants had been delivered, plus 2,000 more that were built under license by foreign manufacturers. Today's C-47A Skytrain from the Liberty Foundation accurately represents C-47A 43-15137, Chuck 40. Which flew with the 306th Troop Carrier Squadron 7H, 442nd Troop Carrier Group. But before it came to the Liberty Foundation, it had played its own important role in World War II. Built in 1943 in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, it began service with the U.S. Navy transferred to the U.S. Army Air Force, and was then finally leased to the Royal Air Force and sent to England. The aircraft served with distinction in combat, towing a glider on D-Day and participating in many named offenses, including Operation Market Garden. Please welcome Liberty Foundation founder and aircraft owner, Don Brooks.
Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to 2022 Warbirds Interview. This is Don Brooks. This is Ray Fowler. He's one of the pilots. And we also have John over here. You're one of the pilots also, right, John?
Yeah.
And over here is Pat Epps. And he is the backbone, I guess you would say, of the Lost Squadron Greenland Expedition. We'll be talking to him in a little bit. Have a seat, folks.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about, and I don't know, John, maybe you could tell us this, about the history of the DC-3 C-47, about its initial, 1935, 1936?
Yeah, December 17th, 1935, the first commercial DC-3 started service. And then, of course, by the start of the war, they needed to adapt an airplane to be able to, for military service, and it turned out to be the perfect airplane. Got modified to be a C-47, which had some higher gross weights, cargo doors, different engines. The Pratt & Whitney engines on them made them a fantastic airplane, and as evidenced by the fact that they're still flying now.
Well, now, they manufactured them up to when? The end of the war?
Yes, it was just after the end of the war. I think 44 is actually when they made the last C-47. I believe it was.
All right, now this particular airplane, when was it built?
So the difference is whether you're talking Chalk 40 or this airplane. So
this particular airplane, this airplane.
All right, I'll let Don answer to that.
Okay, this airplane came out of the Oklahoma City plant in January of 1944, and it made it over to the UK in time to take part in the Normandy invasion, June the 6th, 44, and a lot of other operations during the war. So, you want to expand on that? Or?
Well, no, that's fine. This airplane, since you've had it, has had three different paint jobs, right?
Yes.
One for the Greenland Expedition and the other one. Now, tell us about when you made your trip over for 1994.
Okay, yeah, when we first bought this airplane, I bought it in 1988, and it was hauling freight. It was red and silver. Basler actually rebuilt the airframe in 1986, so it was in excellent shape. We needed a transport category aircraft to use to go to Greenland, so we bought this. I bought it in 1988. We put snow skis on it and flew it to Greenland for the three big expeditions in 1989, 1990, and 1992 when we brought the P-38 Glacier Girl back.
Okay, the paint job in 94, that was British, is that correct?
Yes, the first paint job was British. It had the roundels. It was based out of England, and the Brits used it until the initial glider tug into Market Garden. You know, then they transferred it to the RCAF, and it flew the rest of the war with the RCAF. It did seven resupply drops over Arnhem, and they said each time they went back, they had more German anti-aircraft and guns. And this one was actually hit on its seventh resupply drop, low level. It was hitting the left wing by anti-aircraft fire, and it made it back to its base in England, and they repaired it, and it went on to take part in Operation Market Garden, which was the largest airborne operation of World War II. It was, that was the crossing of the Rhine into Germany.
Well, how about your trip over in 94, and back, and then St. Mary Glace? Could you get into that, please?
Yes.
Well,
glad
the trip
to.
Over particularly.
Yeah, the trip... We had used the airplane for 3 years to go to Greenland, And we had a group of American paratroopers that actually took part in World War II in the Normandy invasion that wanted us to paint the airplane, you know, in its combat markings and fly it back over there in 94 for the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And, you know, we didn't start out with that intention, but they told us they had found two planes in France that they could use that were C-47s. They called about 6 months before D-Day plus 50 and said that they had these planes were involved in a bankruptcy. They couldn't get them, so they were in trouble. They didn't have anything to jump out of. So we put a rush paint job on the airplane. You know, it was red and silver when we were taking it to Greenland, high visibility colors. We put a rush paint job on it and painted it in olive drab, and its military markings had the British roundels. And flew it back over in May of 1994 for the 50th anniversary. Had 26 actual D-Day paratroopers that jumped again over St. Mihiel-Glies, you know, 50 years to the day after they had jumped, and they did great. It was a good day. Pat Epps, who, you know, Pat Epps was the leader and the organizer of the Greenland expedition, and so Pat's got a lot of time in this airplane, but Pat was the guy that really managed to make it possible for us to get to Normandy on D-Day plus 50, and it was a windy day. They had the parameters set for the jump over St. Mihiel-Glies, and they said that if the wind was more than 14 knots, that they would cancel the jump. And all day long, the winds had been too high. We took off from Le Havre, France, with our 26 paratroopers on board. Pat was pilot in command. You know, he kept getting a wind check from the jump site, and it was always the winds were too high. And we had a whole aviation brigade out of the UK, American paratroopers, on C-130s. They were a lot of C-130s headed across the channel. They were listening too. So when we were a few miles away from the jump, Pat checked the wind check again. It was too high. So all of these C-130s turned back to England. And as we got closer, Pat checked one more time, and miraculously the wind was like one knot lower than the max, you know, because these paratroopers had told us if they couldn't jump, they were going to go out anyway. So they were a determined group, you know, they were great. The youngest one was 68 years old. He was 18 on the day he jumped into Normandy, and the oldest was like 84. He was a full colonel. So anyway, these were a great group of guys, but, you know, so we dropped our guys, and when the American C-130s heard these guys were jumping, they scrambled. They had to turn around and head back to the jump site, and it was windy. It was really bad, probably like the original Normandy, but it scattered those guys all over the place. They did have three injuries, nothing more serious than a broken leg, but they got their jump in too. So we had a great time. One of our jumpers went out the door and managed to get his parachute shroud or his lines tangled up, and we were worried about him, but he had the presence of mind to get his primary chute off. He deployed his reserve, and he hit the ground a little hard, so the medics picked him up. They were taking him off on a stretcher to check him out. And so we hurried back to Le Havre, and we went in the lounge there, and we watched the replay on TV, you know, the news. And they were asking him, "Are you all right, sir?" And he was slinging his arm around. "I'm fine. I'd be doing better if they'd give me a beer." So, those were great guys. We took off from Le Havre, and we left the jump door on the ground. We had so many people in the plane. And when we went to full power on takeoff, you could hear a roar from those guys, you know, that jumped 50 years before. And I told Pat, I said, "Pat, that's the spirit that won World War II. You could hear it over 24 horsepower, 2,400 horsepower these engines turning, you know, at full power. So, but it's a great experience.
Well, Don, to backtrack a little bit, let's get back to talk about the Greenland expedition and the Lost Squadron between you and Pat, and you can ask Pat whatever you care for.
Okay. And Pat, anytime you want to, you can join in. They was asking about the Greenland expedition. I know Pat went to Greenland 5 or 6 times looking for the group. And for those that don't know, there were six P-38 twin-engine fighters and 2 B-17 heavy bombers that were on their way to England in 1942. The first, and it was called Operation Bolero. It was the first mass movement of American warplanes and crews to the UK to help the Brits over there. So the first plane to go across, the first group to go across was 4 P-38s and a B-17. And it's funny that the first one across was piloted by Paul Tibbets. And, of course, he's the guy that eventually organized the B-29 raids and dropped the first atomic bomb. But the second and third groups got together because of weather. So the second and third B-17s and 6 of the P-38s started across. And coming out of Greenland, they were headed to Reykjavik, Iceland. They got there, and there was a sea fog, so they couldn't land. They turned around and headed back to the base in Greenland. They were blowing off course to the south, and they didn't have enough fuel to make the base. So they elected to land as a group on the ice cap so they wouldn't be scattered out over hundreds of square miles. So anyway, they landed, you know, nobody was hurt. The brand new airplanes were left behind. The guys were rescued a few days later. So anyway, Pat went up 4 or 5 times to try to locate them. He finally found them in 1988 using subsurface radar. And then that's when I got involved. I read about it. And I provided this DC-3 with skis so we could go back with a bigger group in 89, 90, and 92. And that was just, it was an adventure of a lifetime. In 89, we bored down to one of the B-17s and we used a hole saw to bring up a small piece of airplane skin. And there was 270 feet below the surface. And that gained us an extension on the salvage rights from the Danish government. And we tested a machine that I developed and took up that year. We tested a meltdown machine that could actually go into the ice. And we didn't have but a few days to try it, but we found out the principle worked. And there were a couple of things we changed. So anyway, we went back in 1990.
How big was the machine?
The production machine was like 4 feet in diameter, and it could melt a hole straight down till we hit the airplane. Then we would use the hot water that we were sending down to the meltdown machine, which we called a gopher, and blast a cave around the airplane. So you go down on a cable. 270 feet, you know, and then you got this airplane that the rear of it still covered in ice. You're in a cave. And we brought back parts of the B-17 that was crushed badly. And then we, thinking that maybe we wouldn't go back, because we had found the airplanes. We had figured out how to get down to them, and they were crushed almost beyond repair. So, but we were talking about it, and Pat decided, you know, in 1992, we need to go back and get one of the P-38s. So we did that, and brought the P-38 back to, actually, we left the ASCAP, brought most of the P-38 back in this airplane. The two engines, the outer wing panels, the gun nose, most of the tail surfaces, everything but the center section, the biggest part, wouldn't fit in there. So we brought that back one night, and Pat was flying, and we landed. We landed out here, and it was late at night, and he taxied down to where they put the Warbirds on the big line down there, and Warbird Center. And, you know, we had a one of the campers saw us coming in, and of course the snow skis have skid plates on the back to keep them from wearing. You land on pavement, those skid plates shoot sparks back, you know, 20 or 30 feet. And guy saw us come in, he woke up, you know, and of course those engines at night, you see the blue fire lapping out of the exhaust too. But the guy ran all the way across the airport, met us when we shut it down. He just was out of breath, but he won't let us know that the airplane he thought might be on fire. You know, he saw all of that. So anyway, we appreciated the thought, but we weren't on fire. So we displayed the airplane parts and the plane the next day here at Oshkosh. Had tens of thousands of people come by to see it. And I can remember Pat was telling them about it, you know, and he'd tell them, he said, feel that part. He said, it's still cold. Came out of 270 feet below the surface. But the day before, we had been on the ice cap, and then we made it here. So,
well, what was your interest in going to Greenland to start off? I understand that you were interested in the B-17, and for what reason?
Yeah, the B-17, you know, I grew up, I came along shortly after the war, and at a time when all the kids in school say, what'd your father do during the war? You know, and of course mine was a tail gunner on a B-17. So I was, you know, my father encouraged me to fly. I learned to fly, you know, fairly early, and never got into warbirds much until I read about Pat finding these in Greenland, and called him and got involved. And he was good enough to let me get involved in it. But I really wanted to try to find a B-17 I could recover, rebuild, you know, and fly it around the country so people could have a chance to see it and learn about the great sacrifice of our veterans.
Now, the particular, the B-17, was the pilot still alive at that time? The parts that you recovered?
No, the pilot was not alive when we went up and brought those parts back 50 years after he had landed there. We did meet the pilot's wife. Pat gave her the B-17. He had Phyllis Arlene painted on it, and we brought that back, and Pat presented that to his wife on NBC Morning News with Deborah Norville in Atlanta at PDK. So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I was just going to say that, you know, Pat was absolutely the leader of the Greenland expedition. He put it together. He made it happen. He was also the sole reason we were able to make that jump 50 years after D-Day, you know. But, Pat, if you have any comments you'd like to make about the Greenland expedition or our trip to...
Don Brooks came up with the idea for what I call a gopher. It was like a kid's spinning top, but he called me up from Douglas, Georgia, where he lived, and said that he's got the solution, how we going to get down to the airplane. And it was about 4 foot high, and he had copper tubing wrapped around the nose of this cone-shaped. We called it the gopher, and we could run hot water through it. It would melt a hole, and that's what we used to get down to the airplane, drilled 250 feet to get through the Greenland ice cap. And then once you got a good hole, a tunnel to drop down in. Anyway, Don came up with that idea on how to drill a hole in the Greenland ice cap. And I don't know whether he made two or three of them, but at least he had one at work. And he called me from Douglas, Georgia, says, come look what I built. And I went down there, and he run the hot water through the copper coil, and he had 10 blocks of ice from the ice plant in Douglas, and he showed me how to drill a hole through the ice cap. And so we knew we had a way to get to the airplane now. So Mr. Brooks come up with that idea and built the Gopher, the device we use to drill a hole.
And he's got
the path. 250 feet down.
How about, you mentioned earlier about bringing the machine guns out of the, for the P-38.
Yeah, the first machine guns we bought back were in 90 out of the B-17 top turret. We brought that back as a souvenir. We turned the guns in at Burlington, Vermont Customs. Took about 2 years to get permission to get them. We had to disassemble the machine guns, cut the right-hand side plates into three pieces, and then technically we were importing gun parts instead of guns. You can't import guns, you know. So anyway, we put them back together with dummy side plates. So we have the guns back in the turret on display now, but they don't shoot.
Did they shoot when you first got them out?
We shot one of the B-17 machine guns. We fired it on the cap with the original ammunition from 1942. And of course, when we brought the P-38 up in 92, we fired the 20-millimeter cannon with the original high-explosive incendiary ammunition, so it still worked.
Well, tell us about your problem with the engine on takeoff.
Somebody had brought up when the last year we were in Greenland and with the DC-3 in 1992, we had an engine that on the right side that we knew was short-lived, and it's a big problem to try to change a DC-3 engine on the ice cap. But first, you got to get it out there, and that's a massive job for an 1830 engine out there. And then to try to change it, you need some equipment. So Pat, again, was our leader, and, you know, Pat made the decision that we really need to get this airplane back to Coolosuke, where we have forklift, and we can change the engine more easily. And he said, you know, I think that maybe we can limp back to Coolosuke with it. In reality, he knew that the engine wasn't going to last long, but he got it in the air. He took off, warmed the left engine up. The right engine didn't have a lot of time, so he started it and pretty much took off right away. And both of them were producing power, got it into the air, and about that time, the right engine came apart. And it looked like a flare on that right side. It blew the cowling up into the prop. He climbed a little more, got some altitude, and turned, headed back to Coolosuke. And of course, where we're on the cap, it's about 2,000 feet above sea level. Coolosuke's just a little above sea level. So 100 miles. So he shut down the right engine, still feathered the prop, and the plane flew fine. He flew it back to Coolosuke, landed. We had another engine shipped up, got it about there 2 months later, and we changed it, and Pat flew the thing back to Georgia. So, Pat, you want to comment on that?
Tell them about the betting, about whether you were going to make it or not.
See, I had a guy out of Denmark in the right seat, and somebody said something about on the ground, said, your right engine's on fire. So I just asked the co-pilot, I says, would you look out there and see if it's, he says, yes. Oh, okay. So we just shut the mixture off, cut the gas to it, and fly for an hour, as Don said, the 100 miles back to Coolosuke, and they will fly on one engine. So you just do what you got to do and do it.
Tell us about the bidding on that. About bidding on whether you're going to make it or not.
Yeah. You know, the Coolosuke Airport is maintained mostly by Danish workers, and at that time anyway. And they have to keep the airport open all year, and during the winter they get a tremendous amount of snow. So anything, they have one ramp that they keep clear, they scrape it, You know, you can go over there in the winter and the runway is down in a hole that's probably 8 or 10 feet deep, you know, and they scrape it, keep scraping it, blowing the snow away. And they clear this one ramp where planes can come in, turn around and unload and go back out. So anyway, our DC-3 was sitting there with a broken engine after we made it back from the ice cap. And we had to ship an engine up. That was going to take probably 60 days to get it there. So we all went home and had the engine shipped. And then when those guys make pretty good money at that airport, but they don't have much to do for entertainment. So they've started betting that we wouldn't come back in time to save the airplane. If we didn't get back before the big snow, they were going to push it down into dump and just push it off the end of the runway into the dump. And there was another DC-3 down there that was pushed in because it had a bad mag and they didn't get it changed in time. So anyway, we didn't know it, but they were betting big money that we wouldn't come back. And the guys that knew us best, like the airport manager, a guy named Torben Dahl, a few other people, they bet we would, but we didn't know it. So anyway, the day we showed up, Bob Harless and I got there first on commercial out of Reykjavik, Iceland. And the door opened, and I've never seen all these guys on the runway so glad to see us. I didn't know why, you know, but it's because we came back to get that airplane. And then we started changing the engine, and they gave us all the help we could possibly want, equipment, anything we needed. And then Pat showed up 2 or 3 days later. You know, he was going to fly it back for us, and we had it about ready, and then we worked late that night. It was awesome. The weather was pretty, and most unbelievable northern lights you've ever seen over the mountain there at Coolasuit. But anyway, we fired it up, you know, late and taxied down to the active ramp, you know, which meant we were going to leave. And they had a dinner for us that night at the mess hall, you know, big party. And of course, they believe if you take the top off a bottle, it has to stay there until it's gone, you know. So anyway, we didn't participate in that, but they had a big time. And so anyway, the first bet was we wouldn't come back to get it. Well, they won that one because we did come back to get it. Then they started another bet that said it wouldn't ever fly away from that airport. So we won that one too, you know. We took off and came, Pat did a low pass right down the ramp, you know, and we could see these guys out there handing money back to them. We didn't know what that was all about, you know. And then, again, they made the next bet. Well, that thing will not make it all the way to Atlanta, Georgia. So our same guys bet on us again. And when we landed at Peachtree DeKalb Airport, Epps Aviation, as soon as we shut the engine down and opened the door, one of Pat's people came out and said, Pat, there's a guy from airport manager from Coolasuit, Greenland, wants to talk to you. Okay, so Pat went in. He said, yeah, we got here. We doing good. Torben said, okay, thank you. And Torben and his guys won so much money from that bet about this airplane that he put in a cable TV service at Coolasuit and ran it across to where the village was. So he did pretty well from that series of bets.
Pat, you have any more comments?
No, it's Mr. Brooks. Of course, he had the DC-3, and I just conned him out of, we need to go up to Greenland, and if you haven't seen Greenland, you need to go to Greenland, Don. And I sold him. I got a gold star for my airplane salesmanship that day.
Pat did great.
I didn't con Don into it. It didn't take a whole lot of convincing to get him to participate from South Georgia down there and 250 miles below Atlanta. And my brother Ben had been a flight instructor there in 42, and that's when Don and his folks were down there. And Douglas, Georgia was a primary flight school for the military, World War II. And Don has now got him a museum down there in a Quonset hut like this over here. And tell us a little bit, you got anything there now? You got some P-38 guns there.
Oh, yeah. We have Well, we got the top turret from the B-17. We may talk about it later. We're rebuilding a B-17 there that we hope to fly in 2.5 or 3 years. And so we stay pretty busy, but we do have a museum there dedicated to 10,000 pilots that learned to fly there during World War II. And, you know, we had some that turned out pretty good. Charles Loring learned to fly there. He earned the Medal of Honor in Korea. They named Loring Air Force Base after him. A guy named Rosie Rosenthal, most decorated bomber 100. Pilot of World War II, learned to fly there in our little town of Douglas. And
Bloody 100th.
Yeah, and they're doing a movie on it now that's going to be unbelievable. It'll air sometime in early 2023, and it'll be about the 8th Air Force out of England. So they had done the Band of Brothers and the War in the Pacific, so they're doing a new one now. But can't wait to see it come out.
Ray, this is Ray Fowler, by the way. I didn't introduce Ray properly. I met Ray when he was, 18 years old or something? He knocked on the wrong door, my house. Ray is a Lieutenant Colonel in the Air, Alabama Air National Guard F-16 pilot. He's flown 5 combat tours. He's a real hero. Afghan, Iraq, Syria. His Warbird qualifications include, not all of them, but P-51, P-82, P-40, P-47, Corsair, ME-109, B-25, B-17, P-38, and a Beaver and a T-6, and probably some others that I don't know about. Now, Ray, pick us up from this paint job, explain this paint job and what you guys are trying to do with all of your, all of the demonstration stuff that you have here.
Thanks, Sam. And so I'll take it back even a little further. So growing up in Georgia and starting as a young flight instructor, I had heard about the Greenland Expedition, obviously, and had the opportunity very early in my career to meet Mr. Epps. My first Warbird I got to fly was based at Epps Aviation at Peachtree DeKalb Airport. So I'd get to see him come in and out with the DC-3 and just like anybody else in all these airplanes. And I'm still the biggest kid here. You know, I just drooled over the possibility of actually getting to ride in one, much less getting to fly one. I'd also heard of Don Brooks, and I can't say enough. I mean, both these guys are Hall of Georgia Aviation Hall of Fame, what they've done. If you haven't read that expedition, it fascinated me before I ever even had an opportunity to talk to them in person. So I kind of sit back, in this environment, you get to meet people that you read about in books, and again, they do not disappoint. But to this airplane itself, I had the opportunity once I met Don. I came down and did his air show in Douglas, and he had a phenomenal air show. Douglas is almost into Florida, so I still live in Atlanta, just to the west. Douglas is, the further you go south, the more you get away from where I live in Atlanta. So Douglas is still, I would say a small town and almost to Florida, and went down and much in the middle of nowhere, he had a phenomenal air show, and I got to be good friends with him into Liberty Foundation. So at the time, his three, after they used it for the expedition and went and did his 50th anniversary in D-Day, I think pretty much the airplane, you guys kept proficiency in it and flew it around, and some other people that are still very involved with Liberty. Joey Hand, he flew up here with you as well. And so I think you just flew the airplane to go to some events and shows, right? And it really didn't have a lot of purpose outside of what Don has built and continues to build for the Liberty Foundation, which we'll talk about a little later. So his airplane was there. It was, since he went back to the D-Day squadron markings, they painted the airplane, and it was getting fairly weathered. The airplane was starting to look a little ratty. I fly for Delta Airlines. Of course, Sam flew for Delta Airlines forever as well. And Delta always puts on, they're very veteran friendly. They love having a great event. They bring in modern military, every airplane they can get. And so they said, man, we would love to have the C-47 in. And we also brought our B-17 in for them, B-25, some other airplanes. Well, I think they took pity on us for our paint because the paint was literally coming and chipping off, and which worked out really well. So they approached us at the time and said, we really would like to talk to you about sponsoring a paint job on your airplane. So I guess it's good to show up with an airplane that has paint falling off of it when you show up. So in conjunction with Delta Airlines, we ended up taking the airplane to Lake Charles, Louisiana, to Landlock Aviation. And though it's just been an amazing process of the paint that we're coming in. But let me back up just a little bit. We wanted to look at how are we going to paint the airplane. So at one point, Don had a group approach him, and the airplane was halfway repainted as the Jungle Strippers, or Skippers, excuse me, Jungle Skippers, Freudian slip. So that's what we called it. It's the Jungle Skippers, which, again, was a very unique paint job itself, but without the invasion stripes. And we wanted to go back to a U.S. paint job, even though this airplane, as a Lend-Lease airplane, went to the RAF. And like Don said, actually, this actual airplane flew on D-Day. It towed a glider on D-Day, Market Garden name. But we have several jump teams, one being the Liberty Jump Team, not associated with the Liberty Foundation, but Liberty Jump Team, the Air Demonstration Team, a lot of the people that actively jump out of airplanes. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but they want to jump out of a U.S. airplane. So we started looking for a new, what would be something we could honor this group of people that have done so much for our freedoms. I came across a beautiful painting that's on just searching the internet to try to do something had not been done before. Artist's name is Ron Cole. I tried to call him several times just to get the background on that airplane. And once I got with Ron on the phone, he gave me the backstory about a gentleman which was actually going to be here at Oshkosh to talk about the airplane. Van Valkenburg, he's with Questmasters. He commissioned the print, and he actually did, wrote an amazing 600-plus page documentary that he has on the 306 Troop Carrier Squadron. And this actual paint job, which we call Chalk 40. So as you guys know, or may not know, in World War II, when people would walk out to the airplanes in the chalk that they would jump with, and it was at 26 jumpers, or how many people jumped in World War II? You remember, Don? How many did you have jump out of the
back?
Make
up some.
We had 26.
Yeah, so I think it was like, I've heard as many as 30, but it would jump out of the airplane. But they would walk out in chalk, and they would literally write in chalk by the back door the chalk number, so the jumpers would know which airplane to go climb on. Obviously, when you have dozens, if not hundreds, of airplanes that they're loading on to go load into their chalk. So if you look, it's part of the graphic on the back door of this airplane. We actually have the 40. You may not be able to see it from your seat there, but we actually have the graphic from the 40, which would depict this airplane literally on June 6, 1944, as the jumpers would come out of the airplane. So once we looked in, and I got to Van, and he was so helpful with the history. He knows every person sat in every seat of this airplane, and obviously that was a mission specifically, which would Chalk 40 was just for that day. And we know the history of the paint scheme for some other name jumps where were different chalk numbers. But again, as you'll see, all the C-47s that fly, you know, people want to tell the story, and the way we tell the story is through Chalk 40. So anyway, after I looked at the print, and we kind of talked about it and thought it was a really good-looking paint job. I did ask him about the nose art, and you'll see the cards and the four aces on the paint. And ironically, this is homework for anybody here that wants to help, and I don't know that you'll get there, but we have original pictures of the real airplane before, and it was scrapped at some point after the war. But there was actually some nose art written above the cards, and we can't tell what it says, so we're going to add that when we find a family member can tell us what that said as far as the aces go. But we do know the history on the airplane. Ironically, Van actually has the original cockpit too, Chalk 40, that flew. He was able to run it down to records before it was scrapped and save the cockpit. But again, it enhances our mission for what we do to continue to do jumps. And in fact, next month we'll do a Benning jump, and we'll have active duty guys jump out at Fort Benning next month in August on the 19th of August, and then we'll do another jump on the 20th of August. So that's how we support the mission. Delta, Landlock, all the people that actually stepped up to paint the airplane, this will be really the third airplane they painted for us, and it's just everybody comes together to keep these airplanes going, and we hope to continue to do the same thing.
Explain the significance of your cargo here.
So that's another thing that the same gentleman that is so smart on everything to do with the markings and little things that you wouldn't think of as like the Pathfinder antennas that you see that were originally on this airplane, very difficult to find. He is into every little detail to include, and I'm sorry to point, that's the, what some people would say, what's that ugly antenna up on the front? Well, it is kind of hideous, but that was an original Pathfinder antenna that they would use as part of their DF finding to make sure they went to the right jump zone, which I'm sure was not always an easy task to find out where you're going to go jump. All of the items that you see here, we actually he approaches as well, and this is what he does. All the marking, stenciling, the right kind of container, the size, everything, just like they said in the video of what won the war. You know, the C-47 really was the backbone for not only hauling troops and sending people into combat, but hauling supplies and dropping supplies. This actual airplane, you know, I'm sure sent a lot of these supplies out of the airplane as a part of Market Garden for resupplies. And so it's kind of one of those things. We love the history, just like with, you know, watching all the people with the outfits and the military vehicles. And again, this is just one small part, which outside of the C-47 we're going to talk about, and I know you'll get to it, Sam, a little bit about our B-17, B-25, well, and some other projects, and I know we'll get to
it.
But sure, that's so when you get a chance, come down and look at some of the things, to include the mortar rounds, and that's exactly as it would look and how it would be loaded in the C-47 in World War II.
Now, do you carry this guy around with you so he can sleep under the wing all the time?
Yes, he goes everywhere we go.
Well, tell us about your foundation. Now, this is a different story altogether, you and Don both.
You want to start with that, Don? Or?
Yeah, we started the Liberty Foundation as a nonprofit educational foundation. We started it back in 2002 when we actually bought the B-17 Liberty Bell. It was under restoration down in Kissimmee at Tom Riley's restoration facility. You know, we've got it, had to finish the restoration. He did that for us. You know, we flew the airplane for the first time in late 2004, I'm pretty sure, and started putting it on tour in 2005. And we've had tens of thousands of people, literally, that have flown in that airplane. You couldn't count how many went through on ground tours, but we've been all over the U.S., you know, with it. Ray and I took it to back to England in 2008, and Ray might talk about that some. It was a great trip. We flew over, went to a lot of the big air shows. The people in the UK are unbelievable. They still appreciate and honor our veterans from World War II. It was unbelievable, the people that would turn out at every stop that we made in the airplane. At Prestwick, Scotland, we cleared custody. You know, we went in there initially. I mean, there were thousands of people. We saw the paparazzi firsthand. It's, you know, they'd fight to get an interview. Went on to Duxford, checked in with those guys. They have the biggest war show in Europe there every year, and we were going to be part of that. Went down into London for a little R&R. Stayed a few days and flew back out, you know. But everybody was super nice. We went to several museums that were ex-World War II control towers, you know, and the people there still put flowers out for these veterans, you know, from 1944. And it's unbelievable. Brought the airplane back. So the foundation has done a lot. And I have to say that Ray Fowler has been the executive director ever since we started it, also the chief pilot. John Hess has flown countless hours for us, does just a wonderful job, and still helping us. We got new instrument panel, new interior, all of the things that John's been behind pushing to get done. So, you know, we just keep getting better, and we have some new things that I'll let Ray mention.
Ray, tell us about what your future plans are for the foundation.
So many of you guys, obviously, once we got involved with the B-17 Liberty Bell, if you guys saw an airplane that actually had an in-flight fire in 2011 and landed in the field, that was our aircraft. So that was the Liberty Bell. Actually, John was in the left seat and actually did a spectacular job. I was in front of him with a different airplane. That had gone ahead for us to land in Indianapolis, but he took off at Aurora, Illinois, had an in-flight fire, did a phenomenal job, had the airplane on the ground in a minute and a half in a field, and sadly, the fire trucks were not able to get to the airplane to put the fire out. However, most people, if you look at the end result of that, it was a total success in our minds. Nobody got hurt. We can rebuild airplanes. Not that it's ideal to burn your airplane up and start over, because Don's first B-17 took 14 years, 15 years. So anyway, we pretty much started from scratch from that. But John did an amazing, ability to get the airplane into the field. And we started rebuilding that airplane pretty much as soon as we got the, what was left of it back. So we hope in 3 years, maybe 4 years, it's just a matter of pouring enough liquid dollars into the account to keep paying the bills. And that's where really the public comes in for us. I mean, we look to the donations to survive as a 501c3. The most exciting thing that happened to us here just recently is we had a full B-25 donated to us from another nonprofit. So it's a flying B-25, so we'll have that up for you to talk about next year up here. Delta painted that for us as well at Landlock, so it's getting a new paint job right now and going through some checks before we put it out on tour. But museum closed on the West Coast, and they were nice enough. They had known our story, and they had safely operated that airplane for 50 years, and we're the new custodians of the airplane to continue telling its story down, and we'll hopefully tour and give public tours with that airplane for years to come. So we're excited about it, and many people don't know our Liberty Bell is going to fly again, but everything we every dollar we bring in, we put into the foundation to keep the airplanes flying.
You have any other comments you want to make before we open up to questions?
Not much. I just say that, you know, it's been such a pleasure for me to be a part of this. You know, Pat kiddingly said he conned me out of the, you know, getting into the Greenland expedition. You know, I've said, I thank Pat countless times for letting me be part of that adventure. It's an unbelievable story. I mean, we can tell stories for days about it, but I've always said the best thing about getting involved in the Greenland expedition for me was to have the chance to build a friendship with Pat Epps. But a great aviator, you'll never find anybody better to work with or fly with than Pat. And of course, you know, same thing with the Liberty Foundation. Ray's been part of that since we started it, and folks like John Hess. You know, John doesn't talk about being the PIC when the B-17 burned up, but I remember the morning John called me and said, I have to give you this bad news. You know, the Liberty Bells has, we did an off-field landing and it's burned. And first thing I did was thank him for doing such a great job, you know. And I asked him, please don't ever second guess your decision to put it down there instead of trying to fly it to an airport. You know, he just did an unbelievable job. It couldn't have been better. If we'd have had one person killed or seriously hurt, I would have regretted ever getting involved with Warbirds at all. So, you know, I have to thank John for an unbelievable job that he did that day. So, but it's all the way through. We have a lot of our volunteers out here, and, you know, it just means so much. And we do it to honor our veterans. So thanks to all of you that were part, you know, the people that were there to defend our country. And we can never pay the bill, never pay what we owe. So thank you.
Speaking of veterans, will all of our veterans stand up, please, and be recognized? Kyle, do you have anybody over there for a question?
No.
Nobody? How about this side over here? No questions? Surely there's a question.
We did a good job.
Yeah. You guys can come see it. We're going to hang around the airplane anyway, so come talk to us. I know you guys probably spent all your
Wait
money
a minute.
To get
we
here.
We got one over here. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering how the airplane performs and what do you do to practice single engine work if you're training somebody. I know you wouldn't do it at pattern altitude. You'd get up at altitude, but how does it fly when you have to pull one all the way back and practice on one?
That is a great question. We actually, just this year, we got the FAA contract, so we maintain the FAA inspector's currency in this airplane, which will include us literally shutting down, feathering and unfeathering an engine. However, we just replaced, we've been running down a leak on an oil cooler, which we were going up to a jump last month and proceeded to send about 25 gallons of oil out of our right engine. So I shut it down, This airplane flies phenomenally on one engine. Now, I wouldn't want to do it at, when I'm full of gas or at different altitudes, or you know. But you think about when they flew with people. We were so light today, so the thing does fly really, really well on single engine. So just like talking about Pat flying the airplane to Kulusuk on one engine. It is a pleasure to fly on one engine. So, yeah, it's a good thing it has a spare. Again, it just depends on the environment of all these airplanes now. We're very light. We use reduced fuel loads. We do really a lot to protect them. And it's worth talking about since really the discussions about the C-47, the DC-3, they never really built an airplane that does what this airplane does. Right. I mean, so Basler and putting the turbine engines on it, this airplane's still working in Alaska. It's working overseas. It does humanitarian work. We get call. I think Don gets calls, and they're trying to buy his airplane because this is really one of the lower time airframes that out and flies, and that's just because it does everything well, and it really does from a volume standpoint. The downside on it, and we pay the price when we go home from Oshkosh. It burns 100 gallons an hour, and we're not a whole lot faster than a Cessna 182. You know, so we're about 135, 140 knots going home at 100 gallons an hour. And of course, at $7-$8 a gallon, that does leave a mark. But it's amazing.
Ray, you might want to also mention that this is the first airplane that the airlines made any money with. Up to that point, they were always subsidized. But at this point, they can make money.
And it's amazing. Just you get it. Every one of these airplanes, you know, have quite a story to tell when you get in to go fly them. But it is pretty iconic. And I know Don, you know, his story is when you're flying it in the weather and it still leaks just as much today as it did whenever it flew back in 1942.
Terrible.
So you're sitting there flying and you're trying to find a trash bag to put over your leg to keep the water from leaking out on you. And that would have been, you know, that's what they flew with before. So it's a very unique experience. And if you have an opportunity, I mean, if I were to pick an airplane that's iconic, you know, to go take a flight in or take a training flight, and we do that sometimes for our training, for second-in-command training, just to go fly the DC-3. It is so unique from most other airplanes we fly.
From a personal standpoint, I don't think if you fly a lot of airplanes, this is going to be one of your favorites. It might not be your favorite, but it'll be up there.
Yeah, it is. But you know the story. For anybody that hasn't heard the story about it, they say when they – retire the last 747 out in the desert, it'll be a DC-3 that picks up the crew to fly them back. And you know, there's a lot less 747s out there already, so I think it's coming.
Awesome. And we have one over here.
Yeah, thank you very much. You sparked a question in my mind when you start talking about the operating costs. Full up, what do you estimate your fully burdened operating costs are annually for this effort?
Wow. Well, if you were to put in the fixed cost of what it costs for insurance, I mean, everything's gone through the roof. It's so hard to put a number on it just because we fly the airplane so little. So when we were fully on tour before COVID with our B-17, we would fly the airplanes 200, 250 hours a year. So every hour we flew, we were able to divide that out a little bit. And I think that is kind of the argument for putting the airplane on the road and keeping it on the road for the public. But just again, you know, right now, $7-$8 a gallon, you know, you're looking just $800 an hour in operating cost. I do think insurance is going to be a big issue. And, of course, engines, you know, you're talking a decade ago, you could overhaul these engines for $40,000. I think the last 1830 that I was talking to someone that had it overhauled was just shy of $100,000 for an overhaul. So it's just everything like we're all paying today for everything really double or triple. So I'm hoping that reset comes. We all hope that happens since we all fly airplanes, I'm guessing, here, if you're here at Oshkosh. But, yeah, it's just hard to put a number on it. To go to our B-17, our insurance for the airplane, even post when we had our fire, we operated up until COVID with two other leased B-17s. That insurance alone was about $130,000 a year. So if we flew it 1 hour, that'd be $130,000 just for the operating cost for the insurance. So it's a challenge, which kind of leads me into, if you guys haven't spent all your money, come buy a t-shirt from us, you know, come over and talk to us. Fran, which is John's wife, is over there. She's responsible for all this stuff, and we're going to set up for that. And I see your P-51 shirt. I just bought one of those. That we flew Bud Anderson, by the way, in the P-51s day before yesterday at 100 years old. So we love it. If you want to leave with a Chalk 40 shirt, we'll take your money.
Anybody else?
And it's going to rebuild the bill.
What are here?
Is there any consideration for this plane going back for D-Day plus 80?
What?
Absolutely. Yeah, they. In fact, the jump teams have already approached us for that. So, again, we do need to find kind of an angel sponsor for that. You know, in today's world, I will say when we went in 2008, we retraced the original route that Don had done before. So we went Goose Bay, Narsarsuaq, Reykjavik, Prestwick into there. I think we went at the second most expensive time in history for fuel to do that, and it was 25 hours from the time we left Bangor, Maine, to the time we touched down into Duxford with a B-17. So hopefully we'll find somebody. If you guys have any rich relatives that want to help us fund that, that is exactly what the Liberty Foundation is all about. I mean, we put every dollar we have to advancing aviation, and I can think of no better thing to be over at the 80th for that jump. I know Don will support it because I've called with a whole lot, you know, more harebrained ideas that he's always said yes to. So we would look good doing that on the 80th. We actually were scheduled to go for the 75th, and we just weren't able to put it together, which was an amazing feat for all the airplanes. I think 16 total airplanes made that crossing, and it's a very active group of people that keep the C-47s active and keep them in the public eye. Great question.
Anyone else? Well, thanks, folks. We appreciate you coming and waiting on us this time. Thank you, Don.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray. Thank you, John.
Pat.
And Pat.